Tonight we're on page number 32 in the lesson book, page 32, looking at Acts chapter 2, verses 43 through 45. So, in Acts 2, 43 through 45, somebody want to read that for us right quick? Thank you for reading that. So in our thought questions, discussion of thought questions, question number one says, what came up on every soul?
Fear.
Fear. And in the last, fear of God, in the last, no, I can't read. In at least two, what two ways is the word fear used in the Bible? And it gives 1 John 4:18, Proverbs 1, verse 7.
When it says fear God and keep his commandments, that means respect.
Yes. A reverence or respect. What's the other type of fear that's talked about in the Bible?
Lack of courage or anxiety.
Yeah, anxiety, fright, fear, dread. Well, I use the same word, I didn't mean to use fear, but I always hate that when you read a dictionary and they use the word that you're defining. I'm like, that's why I'm here. two kinds of fear that we see in the Bible. Most of the time when you see the word fear used, as you'll see in the context of most of the verses that we're going to look at tonight, it carries on the idea of respect or reverence for God. In my family, we had to, Grandpa was the one to be feared. But if he said jump rabbit, the rabbit jumped. It didn't matter who it was. It didn't matter what color the rabbit or how big the ears were. It didn't matter. It hopped. And a lot of that, some of that from his kids' generation was you was in trouble if you didn't move, and he's told to. From our generation, it was because of respect, and we didn't want to see the wrath that would come to us. We had that kind of a fear. That was more of a respect thing for him. And you've seen people like that, and had people like that in your families, I'm sure. You had such a high respect for, you feared what they might do as punishment, but at the same time you had such a respect to them, that was not a problem. The disobedience wasn't going to be there because you respected them. And that's the kind of fear we ought to have for God, the kind of reverence we ought to have for God, is we do it out of respect. We know that he can be severe. We know that he can not take us into heaven. We know that he can take our soul away from us. But on the other hand, as we develop and as we get older in the faith, or I think it's as you get older in the faith, as you get more entrenched in the faith, it becomes less of the fright, dread, and terror of the Lord to more of the reverence and respect. That's the kind of fear we come to, because love and mercy and other things enter into the equation that probably wasn't there in the beginning. And so we obey God because we fear him, having that reverence and respect for him. Question number two, what will a proper fear of God keep man from having? It gives the scriptures there, 1 Peter 3, 13 through 15, Isaiah 8, 11 through 14. Yes, ma'am.
Would it be being afraid or having fear and trouble?
From who? I think that's the key in these verses.
From men.
From men.
From men.
Yeah.
From men, the devil, death itself. Our faith is able to conquer that, and our fear of God helps us to conquer that. And the only fear that truly remains, according to Jesus, is our fear of God, our awe and reverence of Him.
There's a verse that talks about do not fear those who can take the life, those who can destroy the body and soul.
Yep. Yep, Paul mentions that, I believe, that we are to fear Him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell.
Jesus mentioned that in Matthew 10, if anyone's looking for that reference. Matthew 10, 28. Fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear Him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell.
Yep, that's the verse. Matthew 10, 28. Boy, I missed that all the way around. I said Paul said it. Jesus said that.
Well, he talked about
too. He did. He talked about it. We'll get into that a little later. In light of the verses given there, I think it's the fear. We're not to fear man or have terror of men because they can't do that much to us. I'll take that back. They can do a lot to us in the flesh, but they can't do anything beyond that. Question 3. From the following verses, list some of the things men will do when they have a proper fear of God. In Exodus 9, 20, 21, Genesis 22, 1 through 12.
They will regard fear and obey the word of the Lord.
Yeah, they listen to the warning. And they obey it. Many times we have examples in the Old Testament where if they'd have had the kind of fear that's talked about here of God, they might not have veered off to the side or to as much as they did because they would have listened to the warning and obeyed it. But many times they didn't, as we saw the children of Israel do. Letter B, 2 Chronicles 6:31, Jeremiah 32:40. Walk in His ways, yep. This, when we have a proper fear of God, we'll walk in His ways. Letter C, Proverbs 16:6. Mm-hmm. We have a proper fear of God, it will cause us to depart from evil. Malachi 3, verse 15.
It's in verse 16.
Yes, that's right. I remember that now. I had to look. We've run into that before in this book.
God listens to those.
Yep, they're remembered of the Lord when we have a proper fear of God. To me, that's an encouraging verse. Or that's an encouraging thought. I don't know about you, but I'm not one. I don't necessarily like getting praise or receiving praise or anything like that. That's just not in my personality or in my character that much. I'm okay with nothing being said. Really am. I mean, there are times where you wonder how something went. You know, did it go good, go bad? And it's good to get a little feedback. But some people, if they don't get a lot of praise or not remembered for something, they feel like their life is a failure, or the task was a failure. And when I read this and think, that the ones that have the proper fear are remembered by the Lord, it's like if I do this, I can receive something special, and that's being remembered by God, by the Lord, and. To me, the idea of being remembered by the Lord means that you have a special place. It means to me you have a special place.
Romans tells us faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Then if you go to in Hebrews 11th chapter, what we consider the chapter of faith, all the people that are listed, all the people that are remembered and have a place in the chapter, did what God told them to do.
They had the proper fear of the Lord. Respect for him. And most of those folks that's listed in there did not have fanfare here in the flesh at all. Some of them is just the opposite. They was in hiding. But they came through and did what was necessary to be remembered of the Lord. Something positive to think about. Anything else for me to question four? I'm starting to feel weird. We've never gotten this far on a page in a long time through a whole class. Psalm 88, verse 12. Well, I didn't expect to find it that. I did not expect to find it that quick. I think that's the verse you're talking about.
Psalm 88,
12. Yeah. Shall thy wonders be known in the dark, and thy righteousness in the land of forgetfulness? Question number four, from the following verses of study and list some of the things men will do when they do not fear God. Genesis 20 and 11 and Exodus 1, 16, 17 is the two verses. I hope you read more than just verse 11 or you won't get the full idea there.
Murdering or slaying people, especially undeserving of death.
Yep.
Like innocent children.
That was part of the story of Moses. what I found interesting about that in Exodus was they were told by the state, by the government, to kill the children, the males. And they said, we're just not going to do it. We're not going to kill this way. And there's a strong statement in that. That's a good statement or a good example of where God's law takes over, supersedes man's law.
You could go just like one or two verses further and point out how the midwives feared God. And
that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, they wouldn't murder. So you get the opposite of that as well.
And I also think it's funny a few more verses down when they're questioned about it by the Pharaoh saying, why did you do this? And they said, oh, they're just lively. They have them before we get there. Exodus chapter 20, verse 20, Romans 3, 10 through 18. Lots of things listed there.
Yeah, how much do you want?
Well, I kind of summarized it, summarized it this way, is the ones that don't have the proper fear do not do good. Because you start, well, that's just a list of things. It's not good. Verse 10, and as is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Their throat is an open sepulcher. Their tongues they have uttered, they have deceit. And the poison of asp is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known, and there is none or there was no fear of God before their eyes. Well, it's not a very good picture that's painted there at all. If you think about it, it's kind of the condition of man, isn't it? But notice at the beginning of the passage, verse 10, as it is written, this is, if my understanding is correct, this is like a quote, this is like a quote from a common saying or common poem back in that day and time. But get this thing to work.
Some of it's definitely from Psalm 14.
Yep.
Full of sadness, heart, there's no God. None's righteous, no, not one. When the Lord looked down from heaven. A bunch of stuff there.
Well, he is making the argument there. Or trying to make the argument, or convincing them that God's righteousness is better, or God's righteousness is to be upheld. And then as he's making that argument, he switches over to their, you know, the condition of man is bad, because there's none that does good, no, not one. And I think about, see that, and think about it, it's like, man, we can attest to this today and what we see around us. We see so much evil going on, and we see so many people that do not uphold righteousness, don't have any interest in it. And one of my fears is, or one of the hopes that I have in the current generation or the generation upcoming, is there seems to be a little bit of a different take on what on things that we consider good and right and righteousness. Like there's a renewed interest in it, and I'm hoping that will keep going and we'll catch on, or we'll keep catching on amongst those folks. And to me, that gives us hope. But back to the context of our lesson here, we're talking about fear, godly fear, and for those that do not fear God, it's like this passage seems to indicate those that don't fear the Lord, verse 18, these that have no fear of God before their eyes, they're not interested in doing good. They're just not interested in it. Let us see. Nehemiah 5, 6 through 9.
That's talking about usuraries, or people that charge unreasonable amounts of interest on borrowed money. They would probably do it in the temples, like bankers.
Under the Old Testament covenant, so if you had a brother or sister or somebody that was a Jew that borrowed money for you, what were you to do? From you, rather. You lend it to them, and you don't charge interest. Don't charge usury. Interesting concept, isn't it?
And where did that... Okay, where did you get that one?
That's part of the Old Testament law.
Oh, that was their ways.
Yep.
Okay.
That was part of the... When the Old Testament
before
went away?
Yeah.
Or, you know, the... Go ahead.
There's really a practice of the Jubilee that you can find in 1 Samuel all the way through 2 Chronicles. Nobody...
They quit practicing for a while. That was one of the problems whenever...
kind of like the land observing its Sabbaths, too. They didn't like,
yeah.
Land rest on the seventh year for a long time. Like a 490.
Yeah, it's a long time. It's hundreds of years. The Feast of Booths. Some whenever they discovered that they hadn't been practicing that, was that under King Josiah?
That was one of the three set feasts, and they were just completely forsaken.
Yeah, that many people believe that was like 1,500 years that that had been observed since that had been observed properly. I've read that two or three references. Yeah.
I mean, from the time Moses came out of Egypt.
Barely, yeah. So they were under the impression that it had not been observed.
Basically since they came out.
Since they came out. I'm not sure if I put much trust in that, but since I read it more than once, it made me wonder where they got that at. But anyway.
It's been 700-something years from Moses to Josiah. I mean, it's still
a period of time. But, yeah, they were... let's say Josiah, he restored some of that, and then or restored a lot of it. And then when you have the rebuilding of the in Nehemiah's day and Ezra's day, where they rebuilt the city and the temple worship and all that, a lot of that was brought back. Hadn't been preserved for a long time.
You just said, like, well, but that's what sparked in my mind, like, about the year of Jubilee. Like, if I got in debt, then everything was, you know, was wiped out in the year of Jubilee. Like, if I sold myself into slavery,
yep,
then, you know, at the year of Jubilee, I was free.
Yep, you was freed as freed slave.
That passage does reference not selling people into bondage as well. Nehemiah 5:16.
Yep. When I read that, I thought that when I looked at it and thought, I thought about slavery. When men don't fear God, then there's bondage.
Well, it's so much back, yeah. But back in that day, like as far as the Jews, it wasn't so much that they were treated as quote unquote slaves, but it's like I worked in your house, I worked your fields, and I was treated not like a family member, but basically not like a dog either.
And indentured. Like an indentured slave, as we'd say, indentured servant. Number 5, answer the following questions from the verse listed. And the first one, letter A, is how must man serve God? Psalm 2, verse 11.
Hey,
yes, sir. Well, it's...
Well, that guy got 1,500 years, that sounds absurd.
Forgot about Solomon.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's the feast in that month.
So it is very rare that it's mentioned, so it's good that Solomon did that, because it's very rarely mentioned where the kings did it. But, of course, it doesn't have to mention it every single time. You know, that's...
Well, that just gives a... We know that it was observed. At this time, at the time of this writing. Five A.
With fear and to rejoice with trembling.
Yep. How must man serve God with fear and rejoice with trembling? Once again, the fear that I think we're talking about in that verse is talking about reverence and respect. Letter B, what is the whole duty of man, Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13?
Fear God and keep his commandments.
To fear God, which would be to respect God, and to keep his commandments. So it sounds like there's some obedience that's involved in that as well. Many translations say to fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. And to me, he seems to stress further the purpose of his existence. Let us see. Who is acceptable to God? Based on Acts 10, 34, 35.
The one who fears God and works righteousness.
The one who fears God and works righteousness. This idea of working righteousness... to me is indicating that there is something for people to do, something for us to do. It's not just being clean, it's being active and clean.
That fear doesn't paralyze, that fear motivates.
Motivates, yep.
Noah is a great example of this. Noah was a perfect and upright man, found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and yet moved with fear, according to Hebrews 11, prepared an ark to the saving of his household. Was fear of God and fear of what God was about to bring upon the world. And so even a good man who was walking with God, we would say very clearly, still feared God, and it motivated him to take action. It wasn't a crippling, paralyzing fear, but it was a fear that put him into action. So,
yeah, and what was the result of that fear? The saving of his household.
Yes, saving his household.
So sometimes standing alone might be the best thing can happen. He stood alone. you ever done the math on that and seen what year Methuselah died?
Yeah.
Year of the flood, isn't it?
Yep.
And I always found that to be an interesting thing. Doesn't mean that he was one of the evil. He just died that year or died in the flood. I like to think that he didn't die in the flood. But
isn't that true of Lamech as well?
Hmm?
Wasn't that true of Lamech as well?
I don't know. I've never tried to.
Yeah.
Yeah, because his years were like 700-something, and everybody had lived up to like 900-something
years. Yep.
So it seems he was cut off too.
I'm pretty sure he was slow to meditation.
Yeah, I would come here thinking that about him.
All of them were 900-something years old.
Yeah, like.
But not him.
And I've thought about before, what would it be like to live to be that old? If you got to remember, too, the perspective of aging had to be different. You know, because we're wore out in 80 years, 80, 85 years. You don't see a lot of people live in their 90s, and you see more than you once did, but you don't see a whole lot of people live and be over 100. And, you know, how old's the world's oldest person right now, like 117 or something like that? You know, and you think, well, the oldest person known on the earth, you'd think they'd be like 130 or something. but they were not. Also, I think about that day and time in order for populating the earth and so forth. It's probably necessary for people to live that long.
And to be able to have kids for a longer period of time.
Back to a movie I watched a bunch of years ago now, where they went to a planet to where people lived to be about 300 years old. Because, you know, without going into the whole reason behind it. And so the guy stood there before a group of kids and said how neat it would be to be an apprentice for 40 or 50 years before you are able to take their place or to master the thing. And I thought about that in terms of back in the old, you know, when people lived to be that long, of how much knowledge and practice of a certain thing could be acquired, especially in an apprenticeship for, like, you know, being a skilled hunter, learning that for years and years and years under someone else instead of just a handful of years, or woodcrafts or all kinds of things. And thinking about also the handing down of the Word of God or God's will, which was most likely done by word of mouth prior to the flood, or mostly done by word of mouth. Well, if you had overlapping, you know, like 100, 200 years of overlapping with your parents, it would probably be easier to hand that down and to get the word stable by word of mouth. I don't know. These are all weird things I think about laying in bed at night. I just see it as a neat thing. There's an opportunity there that we don't have. Go ahead.
So, to me, the one biblical reason that we're given, there's all those are all sure reasons, too, is that God, the long suffering of God, he was giving them plenty of time because they lived in what a lot of people call the starlight age, patriarchal dispensation. Gotten to be on the ark. Didn't seem to happen, but
What's this crazy coot doing?
Yeah, what's going on here? So that itself preached, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, he was called a preacher of righteousness. Thinking about that too is, you know, he was probably the least successful preacher we have in Scripture, to be honest about it. Preached 100 years and only got about 6-8 people on his side. And that's not to say he didn't have the right message.
You know what Brother Harrod said about that?
What did he say about it?
He said at least he got his family in the boat.
That's right.
A lot of preachers, they focus on everybody else but their own family.
And they miss the family.
And they lose their own family, their own kids and stuff in the process. So that was something Brother Harrod said in, you know, one of his sermons on one of the Jamaica trips. I was like,
yeah,
that'll preach.
That's a good thought. Yeah, he was telling them.
Well, we don't think about this, but the patriarchs, that was a big deal. I mean, that was a bigger deal than fathers are now.
Yep.
You came from Cain. You're a descendant of Cain. You should stay true to his traditions. Can you imagine how strong that was then versus now? We're watered down as everything now.
Our culture
Could
is,
you
yeah.
imagine how hard it would be? It would be harder than people leaving denominations today and leaving their families and being denied. It would be that kind of pressure. I mean, I'm just saying. It's
like the family business.
It would have been immensely challenging to pull anyone out of there. And that's perhaps one of the barriers that Noah faced. I don't know. That's just pure speculation, but just a thought.
Well, another thing, too, is that I think that we don't need to discount is he may have converted lots of other people and they died old age before, you know, in that 100-year span. You know, they were already old when they come across. So, I've got that thought about that too, is, you know, we know at the point of the flood, it was only 8. That was it. But maybe he did convince a few before that died, naturally died before the flood. I don't know, maybe that's not the right thought to have, but I see that as it could be a possibility. Either way, the Holy Spirit didn't choose to reveal it if it was. And so I guess it's not worth spending much time on that thought.
Have you ever seen that? It's sort of atopic over here. That list of the descendants of Adam and all down to Noah and what their names meant in Hebrew?
I have not looked at the meaning of the names, but I've seen genealogies studied over them.
That it's mind-boggling because it basically gives the story of the gospel.
Yeah, it's a gospel message.
It is amazing. Just looking at the names each one gave, each, you know, down through there, it's like people inspired to give them those names because it's really the entire story of the gospel right there. And each one of them.
And that should further prove that God had a hand in it.
Yes.
Should be faith building. Letter D, how are we to submit to one another? Ephesians 5:21.
In the fear of God.
This is a natural place to stop in the lesson because we're going into the next topic, but we've got time to start the next topic, I guess. What great characteristics of the early church is suggested by the expression and all that believed were together?
Unity.
Unity.
United.
They were united in their belief. They believed the same thing. Why did they believe the same thing? Because they were taught the same thing. Exactly what I was thinking, because they were taught the same thing. And hopefully anything else that was there was rejected, or I feel that it was, or else there wouldn't have been that level of unity. Number 7, in your own words, how important is unity to a successful work in the church?
It's commanded, so.
No choice, right?
I'm sure everybody here has seen it, where they have the two donuts, change the gift. You got the hay, and you're pulling in different directions to try to get to the feet. And then it shows decide to pull in the same direction and to get there and eat it.
Yep. Beneficial to all to pull in the same direction. Without unity, first off, we can't please the Lord. Second, we cannot accomplish its purpose if we're all going in different directions. Unity, as we've had several lessons on in the past, is of the utmost importance for the survival of the church. So important that unity is that Jesus, going into question 8, Jesus prayed that the followers in John 17, 20, 21 might be as he and the Father are one. And when I think about how that the Father and the Son were one, that there's not much more unified you could be. So if we want to be unified with them, we must follow them. And so it says, what kind of unity is this, is the question. Well, go ahead.
What were you asking? I'm sorry.
Question 8. What kind of unity is this, talking about the unity between the Father and the Son?
It's perfect and complete.
Yeah, it's
perfect and complete. Yep.
It emphasizes in those particular verses the unity of faith based in the Word of God, first entrusted to the chosen apostles of Christ. That's the real message of unity there in those verses. It goes on to elaborate how that we should be one as He and the Father are one. So the divinity is definitely there too.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
I got to read it. Adam, Hebrew meaning man, Seth, appointed, Enosh, Kilin, Sorrow, Mahalalel, blessed God, Jared, shall come down, Enoch, teaching, Methuselah, his death shall bring, Lamech, the despairing, Noah, rest, comfort.
It's like you're stringing a sentence together, isn't it?
That's it.
It's the gospel message.
That's it.
Yeah. That's one of them things that's neat enough you'd want to hang it on the wall and memorize it. Look at it every day to memorize it. Paul used the physical body to illustrate unity of the spiritual body, the church. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 12 through 25. Question 1 is, what is a recognition that each member is part of the body essential to unity? Or why is it, rather?
All parts are necessary.
People, or men, of the physical body have said that, you know, in times past, that certain organs are not necessary in the body. So, you know, there's even a push. It didn't go anywhere, thank goodness. Not that many years ago, to when a baby was born, they'd go ahead and chop out the appendix and tonsils and things like that. Just because they're going to come out and, you know, they're going to cause trouble down the road, let's just get it over with. And I'm glad they didn't do that, or didn't do that to me anyways. And so what we've learned in the past less than 5 years is the importance of the appendix. They won't take them out anymore. They won't hardly take them out anymore. And now this is what they do for you. If you have an upset appendix, unless it's really, 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 really bad, when they told me this, I was like, I can't believe this went this many years without somebody figuring this out. It's antibiotics. It's that simple. And it'll clean all that up, or help clean that up. Anyway, what I was going to say is what they've discovered just in the recent times, that when a baby is born, the appendix, that's where the appendix has the most benefit to the body. Even though we think it's an unnecessary member later in life, it is a member that helps start the development of a newborn. That's relatively new discovery. What are your tonsils? they discovered their filters. When they once thought they just didn't know what they did, their filters, they filter out things in your body. Well, as you get older, you know, you can survive without them, obviously, because I've survived many years without mine. But they filter out things that other parts of your body cannot filter out. And once they thought they were unnecessary. Part of the leftovers from the, if you read some of the Darwinists, some of the leftovers from the evolutionary process, which is false.
They call it vestigial organs.
Yep.
Because Thomas Huxley was the one after Darwin that came up with that and studied certain fish and turtles and everything. And just because he didn't know what they were in the late 1800s doesn't mean they were, you know, what they were used for. Yep. It's just ignorance in my part.
It is. It's ignorance. Because we learn later.
Because of a science, so-called, you know, of evolution, which is not based in science, interestingly. But people buy into it anyway, because they're told to believe it from a young age on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, one of the many deceptions Satan has out in the world.
Well, the example Paul uses in 1 Corinthians is something we can understand. Hands and ears and so on and so forth, eyes. We know that somebody who's missing these has a different set of challenges than somebody that has all these things. Just for instance, if you have both of your feet, both of your legs going up and down stairs, it's probably not an issue. But if you're one-legged, that might be an issue. And so whenever you think about the example he's given there for unity, well, I guess I'm partly getting into discussion of question B there. Why is each member part, regardless of how feeble, essential to unity? It's because they all perform a different function. They help the body to run perfectly, or the way it was intended by God, because they all work together. You can't have your body parts working against each other, or else it will cause problems. The same thing in the church. We can't have members of the church that's pulling a different direction, or else it's going to upset the body. It's going to cause the body to be sick and weak. And so it's important that the body work together, be unified, and that we don't esteem one part better than another part, because they're all essential for the working of the body. This idea will come back to Acts chapter 2, where they were all, when they had all things common, they were working together, they had this unity. It was very important for them to work together, because they were new in the faith. This was a new religion. And if they hadn't abandoned, and in the near future, they were going to face massive persecution. And if the body was not united, working together, it would become weak and sick and fall apart. Not be a good thing. So it was of necessity, not only commanded, but of a necessity that they be united. So today, as a church body, we need to take special notice of what he says in there about unity and the encouragement given there about unity, because that's how we are going to survive in the 21st century. That's how the body is going to survive, is everybody working together. All members are necessary. That means that all need to contribute. All the organs contribute to the body in order to keep it healthy and moving and doing what it needs to do. And the church is the same way. Any thoughts or comments on that?
You could use even the analogy of cars and stuff. You don't think small parts are important, or, you know, let me go out to your car and pull out a couple little fuses. Let's see if you make it home. Let's see if you can even start your car. I mean,
yeah.
Very small things, but without it, the body doesn't work. And we're still learning about the human body. 100 years from now, we'll probably know, if the world's still standing 100 years from now, we'll probably know a ton more about how the body interfaces and how organs work together even more. You know, we'll understand perhaps even more about the brain. You know, supposedly we only use 10% of the brain. I don't think so. But that's supposedly what, you know, people believe. And so we don't know what that other 90% is doing. It's just man assuming things. just like they are with unnecessary body parts. And over time, we'll learn and figure out that we were the foolish ones all along that made these assumptions.
That's right. Anything else? We'll end right here, pick up with the next question, because it's not a different topic, but it's a little different discussion. All right, appreciate your attention.